I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules about behavior and workplaces were different. That was the culture then. I have since learned it's not an excuse, in the office or out of it, to anyone. I realized some time ago that I needed to be a better person, and my interactions with people I work with have changed. I appreciate the way I've behaved with colleagues in the past has caused a lot of pain, and I sincerely apologize for it. Though I'm trying to do better, I know I have a long way to go. That is my commitment.
Part of Harvey Weinstein's written statement of remorse, as read by one of our producers, Weinstein was responding to a big New York Times story. The paper reported that at least 8 women have received settlements and signed non-disclosure forms after being on the receiving end of Weinstein's unwanted advances. But for people who work in the film business in Hollywood and in New York, the reaction to the story has been mostly knowing nods. And that's because sexual harassment rumors have swirled around Weinstein for decades. So why has it taken so long for these rumors to be substantiated and to be made public? Matt Bellany is editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi there.
Okay, so as I just said, this was basically an open secret, these allegations, and they have been for many, many years. Why did it take so long, do you think, for this to come out?
I think there are two issues at play here. One is the... there are many media outlets, including Hollywood Reporter, that have chased this story in the past. And we know of many different places that have reached out to many different women in the industry, reached out to people that have worked at the Weinstein Company and at Miramax before that, asking these questions. And it really has come down to a lack of people on the record. And what is different in this situation with the New York Times is you have people on the record and you have people corroborating them on the record. And you have an executive who worked at Miramax, who ran Miramax's LA office, corroborating that this is something that occurred at the company and that it was known at the company. So I think in a lot of these stories, it requires a big break like this. And this was the big break.
Mm-hmm. Well, some people are saying this was done by a reporter who's not normally covering Hollywood, and that's part of the reason, or that could be part of the reason, that there's just maybe some reporters in the business or maybe were maybe too cozy with Harvey Weinstein or too cozy, didn't want to burn access or anything like that, or maybe had other reasons not to pursue the stories aggressively.
Yeah, I don't know that that's true. I think that journalism is journalism, and I know at this outlet, I know at a number of others, a story like this is a huge story for whatever outlet gets it. And I think a lot of I know there are outlets that are not Hollywood-oriented outlets that have pursued these stories in the past and ultimately haven't done them. So it's not like there was this conspiracy of Hollywood media outlets to keep this story under wraps. I mean, there are many outlets that chased it and didn't do it.
Okay, I want to play a clip of tape from Lisa Bloom. She's the daughter of Gloria Allred. She's a lawyer, and she usually works on the other side of these sexual harassment cases, advocating for the women. But here she is. She's working for Harvey Weinstein, and here she is talking with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's morning show today.
Did he sexually harass women?
I think Harvey has acknowledged, yes, that there was misconduct over a period of years. This is a very different day. What do you do if you have behaved badly for 30 years? Are you going to continue, or are you going to start, a different approach?
Okay, so some eyebrows raised as to what is she doing on the Weinstein side, and some saying, well, there's a book that she wrote that might be adapted by his company.
That is true. We've written about that in the past. And, I think you'd have to ask her what her specific motives are. But I think a lot of people are finding it strange that she would, on one hand, stand up at press conferences with victims of sexual harassment and represent them diligently, and then take on a client like this who has admitted to sexual harassment, and that she is saying he was a dinosaur or was of a different age, or just the kind of arguments that when you're on the other side, you say, no, that's not an excuse. That is not acceptable behavior.
Mm. Okay. So also there is, he's been connected to powerful political forces in the Democratic Party for a very long time. He's a big donor. Malia Obama had an internship at his company. Did people like Hillary Clinton know about his reputation and these allegations and turn the other way?
I think that's a fascinating question because on the one hand, I don't know the answer to that. And I think you would have to ask Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and any number of prominent progressive and Democratic politicians who have had fundraisers hosted by him and have stood up with him at different events. Michelle Obama called him, you know, a good guy or a great guy or something like that. If it was sort of an open secret in Hollywood, how is it not an open secret in D.C., where he also was a prominent player? But maybe not. Maybe it wasn't. Or maybe no one asked. Or maybe, you know, it just was one of those things where it hadn't been public, so it was not something that people thought about dealing with. I don't know the answer to that question.
So what now? What do you think is the future for Harvey Weinstein?
I think it's a really difficult path forward. I know there's huge, huge chaos going on right now at the Weinstein Company where they are trying to figure out what to do. He's announced he's going to step down for a leave of absence, but what we understand is that he is asking his board that he have a path to return. He doesn't want to step down if he can't come back. And the board, as we understand it, is unwilling to make that promise to him. So I think you're going to start to see people distancing themselves from him in the business. You're going to start to see actors and actresses not want to work with the Weinstein Company. The question is how long that will last. I don't know. And if Harvey goes away and steps away from the company, will the company be able to survive? I don't know. But it's a really, really difficult path for him.
Matt Bellany, editorial director at The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, another big story now. This one from BuzzFeed. It's titled Alt-White, How the Breitbart Machine Laundered Racist Hate. BuzzFeed obtained emails and documents exchanged by Breitbart's top leaders, including former White House advisor and Breitbart chairman Steve Bannon and Milo Yiannopoulos, who was an editor at the time. The emails show the rise of Yiannopoulos as a figure who embraced white nationalist ideas and solicited ideas and tips from leaders in that movement for his stories. Joseph Bernstein wrote the story. He's senior technology reporter at BuzzFeed. Hi.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Okay, so you reviewed emails from 2016, from last year, when Yiannopoulos was writing a story for Breitbart, billed as a guide to the so-called alt-right. And how did that story come about?
Well, the sort of movement known as the alt-right had been building for some time. And it had been building to the point that people on the left and some people on the right, too, the never-Trumpers, had begun to describe it as reactionary and racist. And so Milo decided to do a guide to the alt-right. And to do that, he enlisted some truly heinous people, one of whom is a guy named Devin Saucier, who's an open white nationalist. He helps edit, under a pseudonym, a white nationalist magazine called American Renaissance. Another is the neo-Nazi hacker Andrew Weave Ornheimer. And he essentially crowdsourced the piece. I mean, he asked these people to brain dump and repeatedly edit this manifesto of the alt-right that then ran on Breitbart.
Okay, and then how does that pave the way then for these ideas to get into Breitbart over the course of the next year?
Well, I mean, in the case of this piece, Milo quite literally took these people's edits. Actually, he handed them to a ghostwriter who then gave them back to him. He then gave them to the higher-ups at Breitbart, Steve Bannon, Alex Marlow, who's the editor, Larry Solov, who is the powerful CFO, and they published the piece. And, you know, in a speech in Warsaw earlier this year, President Trump echoed a line from that story.
And then the Mercers get involved just a few months after that story is published, the Mercers being Robert and his daughter Rebecca, billionaires who were big funders of the Trump campaign and also fund Breitbart. So what is their role in Milo Yiannopoulos and his courting of these white nationalists?
Well, they're the bankers, right? I mean, Robert Mercer is this hedge fund billionaire, and he delegates, I think, a lot of sort of political responsibility to his daughter, Rebecca. One of the things that we see in the email is Rebecca actually giving a story to Steve Bannon, who then gives it to Milo, who we know is being influenced by these white nationalists, and then that story coming back out. So they actually had some sort of editorial say at Breitbart, which they part own.
And so how does this then all feed into Donald Trump's presidential campaign?
That's a more complicated question. Certainly, Trump is known to read Breitbart, and I think that more broadly speaking, if the Trump campaign ran on this kind of current of white reactionary anger, I mean, one of the things that these emails show is just how widespread that anger was, and just what an outlet it found in Breitbart.
Right. And since some of these emails are also exchanged between Milo and some writers at places like Vice and Slate.
That's right. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating things about the story is you have people working not just in the media, but in other industries that are sort of known as liberal, who are really chafing under what they perceive to be this kind of censorious liberal orthodoxy. And they found a champion or a voice in Milo and via Milo Breitbart.
Hmm. And so what was the nature of their conversations? What were they talking about?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I have the story right in front of me. There's a editor at Vice, just to give you an example, named Mitchell Sunderland, who actually worked for Vice's women's vertical. It's a feminist vertical. And he encouraged Milo to, quote, mock this fat feminist, talking about the feminist writer, Lindy West, who writes about fat acceptance. So they were literally giving him content to turn into stories on Breitbart.
Okay, so what does this tell you about the general ecosystem in terms of how these ideas then percolate into the mainstream?
It's very divided. It's a kind of pick your side thing, and I think that certainly is a trend that Breitbart got ahead of. I mean, one of the things that was so clear to me reading these emails is that Steve Bannon and Yiannopoulos, to a great extent, they see the narrative of left versus right in a really, really clear way that I don't think the rest of the media always does. And they're able to take these ideas that are kind of floating around in the edges of the conservative ecosystem or, you know, on the fringe, sort of buried in liberal places, and then push them up through Breitbart into the atmosphere.
Now, Bannon has tried to distance himself from these ideas and say that he's not a white nationalist. And are you saying that he's sort of using Milo Yiannopoulos as cover for that?
I think that's one of the things we suggest in the story. I would not want to divine what's in Steve Bannon's heart. One of the things that was very interesting about these emails is the degree to which Milo had his own kind of organization within an organization, making Breitbart content namelessly. In other words, they were making content under his name. And he actually told these people at times not to copy Steve Bannon and the editor of Breitbart, Alex Marlow, on emails because he didn't want them to see the sausage being made.
Hmm. So he's fired from Breitbart, and he's sort of on the outs, I guess. But is he still covertly being supported by the Mercers or any of these people?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things my reporting shows is that Robert Mercer's personal accountant forwarded or initiated a wire transfer, I believe, in March or late February of this year to Milo, and Milo, on that same email, personally thanked Robert Mercer. So certainly they've given him money since he left Breitbart in February.
Joseph Bernstein, senior tech reporter at BuzzFeed, where you can read his story on Milo Yiannopoulos and these emails. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the USC Medical School is in trouble again, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Another day, another scandal at USC. Seems to be how it's going for the school right now. Today, it's the medical school again. The dean, not the former dean, the current dean, Dr. Rohit Varma, is out. Well, I guess he's not current anymore. He's accused of sexually harassing a young female med school fellow. Varma succeeded Dr. Carmen Pugliafito, who resigned last year. The LA Times reported Pugliafito used illegal drugs. He partied with criminals and prostitutes, one of whom OD'd in his hotel room. Harriet Ryan is an investigative reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and she and her colleagues were about to publish a story on Varma when he was let go yesterday. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So USC got wind of your story and decided to act?
I guess so. We had let them know what we were planning to report and asked for their response. And as we were in the final stages of publishing the story, we learned that Dr. Varma was no longer the dean.
And the story basically was detailing his sexual harassment allegation and the fact that USC had formally disciplined him several years ago?
Yes. So in 2002, a younger scientist who was working for him, a female fellow at the medical school, accused him of sexual harassment in a hotel room at a conference they were attending, and then retaliation when she reported him. And the university made a finding against him, finding that he'd acted inappropriately in 2003 and reached a $135,000 settlement with this woman. And then what our story was looking at was, you know, that investigation and that finding, and then the fact that USC had continued to promote Dr. Varma to full professor, and then they made him chair of the ophthalmology department. Then he was interim dean last year, and then this year they made him, in January, he was installed as the dean of the Keck School of Medicine. We were interested in how they had evaluated this finding against him 15 years ago and how they'd taken that into account in deciding to make him the dean of the school.
And so what were your conclusions? So why did they decide to do that? Because they had written a scathing letter to him when he was disciplined, saying his behavior was totally inappropriate and unacceptable.
Correct. And it went in his personnel file, and he was told, you know, this is part of your permanent university record. But, you know, within 2 years, they'd made him a full professor. You know, Dr. Varma is an accomplished researcher and academic. He's published widely on eye problems in minority populations and in children. He's extremely well-funded by the NIH. You know, he has the respect of many people in the scientific world. And it's unclear what USC told us was, you know, we consider this incident in 2002 resolved. What they initially told us was that they considered it a resolved issue, and they considered his character in deciding to make him the dean of the medical school, and they didn't elaborate beyond that initially. And then, as you said earlier, when we were preparing to publish our story, they said that they had received additional information that they hadn't known previously, and that based on that, they lost confidence in him and that he was no longer the dean of the school.
What was this additional information?
I would love to know. I don't. we've asked them more than once. We know that his personnel file, that obviously the university possesses and has possessed since 2002, details this sexual harassment and retaliation complaint and the settlement. Some people on campus in the faculty, current and former faculty members, knew about it, and they're the ones who told us, you know, look, you guys should look into this. We're disturbed by this. But as far as the wider, you know, community of staff and students, it was not a well-known fact. And we know that Dr. Varma had warned, you know, some of his faculty and staff colleagues that, you know, the LA Times is working on a story. It's going to look back at this thing that I did in 2002 that I regret and that I've been punished for and that I've learned from. And, you know, the provost and the president of the university have assured me that I have their full faith and confidence to continue as dean. That was Wednesday. Thursday, he's gone. So something happened in between there.
Right. Well, were there other promising candidates for this job?
We're told that they were, you know, it was a national search. They hired a search committee or a search company to do it, to kind of, you know, beat the bushes and look for a good candidate. And that they had candidates from top universities around the country interested in the position.
Okay, so this comes on the heels of, obviously, the Pugliafito scandal, which you guys wrote about, and also the basketball scandal with Tony Bland. So what's happening with people questioning the leadership ability of USC President Nikias? Is that being, wondered?
No, ultimately, USC is run by the trustees, and they're, a really impressive and powerful group of people. Mm-hmm. And they, the president serves at their pleasure. They run the school. And from what we've heard from them so far is that they have confidence and faith in President Nikias. They reiterated that after the Pugliafito revelations, and I have not heard anything publicly from them different than, this is our guy, we like him. So, since that time, we've had the basketball scandal, here's another scandal at the medical school. But faculty can grouse and alums can grouse, but ultimately it's up to the Board of Trustees. It's their school.
Harriet Ryan is an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, movie reviews, including the new Blade Runner film, and musician Annie Clark, a.k.a. St. Vincent, is here. She'll tell us about her new album and how she sometimes likes to spice up her interviews.
I did, construct a pink box in England and had, a girl in stripper shoes, direct them in, and I made a soundtrack for it that was, really disorienting.
St. Vincent, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It has been a long and difficult week.
I guess you're through, huh?
Finished.
Okay, we may be finished, but Harrison Ford isn't. He is back as Detective Rick Deckard in a sequel to the much-beloved sci-fi noir Blade Runner. Time for movie reviews. Kyle Buchanan is here, senior editor for New York Magazine's Vulture. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Okay, we're going to save that for last.
Yes.
So that'll be our dessert. Let's start with The Mountain Between Us. This stars Kate Winslet and Idris Elba. They're strangers who board a small plane together and...
If we stay here, we're safe. If we leave, search and rescue, they're less likely to find us.
Look, I don't want to die up here because you're too scared to take a risk.
Someone's looking for us.
The pilot didn't file a flight plan.
Nobody knows where we are. We're all we've got, me and you.
And lots of snow.
Lots of it.
They've crashed a small airplane, and now they need to survive.
Yes, and they need to lean on each other in every way that might imply in order to make it down off the mountain. I enjoyed myself with this movie. It has sort of a Nicholas Sparks soul, although it's maybe too proud to admit it. You know, it's a survivalist story.
Well, there is a golden retriever.
It's Idris, it's Kate, and it's a dog. And, even though it has this extremely harrowing plane crash and this story that sounds like it could be, just as harrowing, getting down off that mountain, potentially starving to death, fending off nature and mountain lions and their growing attraction to one another.
She's supposed to get married next day.
That's the romantic complication. Yeah. But it never pushes too hard on the pedal of really making you feel that survivalist aspect. It's there as trappings for this story, for these characters to get to know one another. And I think while you're watching it, you're not really worrying about, you know, are they going to find food? Will they make it down off that mountain? You're noticing Idris's beautiful camel-colored coat or wondering what makeup artist got paid to apply teeny tiny snowflakes to the ends of his eyelashes. It's that kind of film, and as much as it tries to pretend it's not, it is, and I kind of liked that tension almost as much as I liked the romantic tension between the two of them.
And is there a lot of tension? Is it hot?
There's
steamy?
A little bit. Well, not too hot and steamy since we're dealing with subarctic temperatures, but, you know, there are points where I would think the dog would have to go into the other room.
Well, speaking of the dog, why didn't they eat the dog?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked that, Madeline. I have an article coming out about that today. I'm honestly shocked by how canine carnivorous people seem to be. They're really offended by the fact that they don't eat the dog. It is not an eat the dog type of movie. I'm actually charmed by the fact that The Mountain Between Us has put out this new marketing campaign saying, don't worry, the dog lives. I don't know if they were testing this movie and people got really frantic about whether the dog would die, but the dog's A-okay. The dog is along for the ride. A little bit of a third wheel at times, but, you know, sometimes you just need a canine companion.
Sometimes you do. Well, you know, alive, they actually ate humans. So
yeah, well, it ain't alive.
Okay.
No, this is about love and romance, all and right. Secondarily about surviving the elements.
Okay, next up, The Florida Project. This stars Willem Dafoe as a budget motel manager in Florida. Here's a clip.
Hey, Lee, got a situation here. Open up.
It's only second week of the summer, and there's already been a dead fish in the pool.
We're trying to get it back alive.
Water balloons thrown at tourists.
A mother, Mona. You...
Yeah, Mom, you're
a
disgrace.
Oh, that sounds so cute. What is this about?
It's cute, it's brashy, it's small, and it's large. This movie is by Sean Baker, who you might remember did a movie called Tangerine about 2 years ago, a movie that was famous for being shot on an iPhone, but I think even more substantially was about these trans sex workers working in Hollywood. And it was ebullient, it was exciting, it felt fresh. And he manages to bring that sort of approach to people who would live on the margins, not just of society, but of movies, you know, people who don't usually get to have their stories told. So in this case, he takes his camera to this budget motel right outside the Magic Kingdom in Orlando and trains it on this 6-year-old girl named Mooney and her totally negligent but hilarious, awful, wonderful single mom parent. And it's just, you know, it's a collection of figures, these people who are just trying to sort of scrape by in the margins. But what's great about the perspective, and especially rooting it through the 6-year-old's eyes, is that whether it's Disneyland or whether it's this crappy, mostly run-down hotel full of weirdo indigents, she's able to make magic no matter where she is. It's that sort of childlike ability and resilience to sort of apply fantasy to a situation where you don't necessarily know how crushing your reality can be. And it's incredibly done in that fashion. It ends superbly. I think this is going to be a lot of people's favorite movie this year.
It sounds, from what you're saying, a little bit like Beasts of the Southern Wild.
It's not unlike that. I've seen those two compared. I think the difference is, like I was saying, there's a bit of a bratty brashness to this movie, you know,
she's a bit of an Eloise.
Eloise would run for cover. Are you kidding? She'd probably pelt Eloise with water balloons and curse words. And I think that's kind of what's fun about it. This is not a sanitized depiction of anything at all, but in telling that reality and allowing you to feel the fantasy of the way that she treats it, that it's all the more potent.
Mm. Because also, I guess, watching it as an adult, you're also keenly aware that this is an unsafe place for a child to be.
Yeah, you are. But this is an incredibly self-sufficient little girl, a real rabble-rouser, a bad influence on every other child in that hotel. I think you can sort of tell by the way I'm talking about it how much affection I had for this character.
Yeah.
And there's such a good heart and such a great personality from this 6-year-old newcomer Brooklyn Prince as this character. She's great.
How's Willem Dafoe?
He's really nice. He sort of adds this stability to the movie. You know, Sean Baker often works with people that have never acted before or, like, have barely acted at all. The woman who plays the mom in this film, the single mom, is just somebody that he essentially cast off Instagram because he liked her look and her attitude. So to put all of these people, these essential newcomers to the field opposite Willem Dafoe. It's this really good sort of spiky energy.
Okay, that sounds really good. And finally, the much-anticipated Blade Runner sequel, Blade Runner 2049. It stars Ryan Gosling and Harrison Ford. Here's a clip.
You're a cop. I did your job once.
Things were simpler then.
What do you want?
I want to ask you some questions. What happened?
I covered my tracks. Scrambled the records.
We were being hunted.
By who?
Okay, Harrison Ford is back as Rick Deckard, the Blade Runner. He's been missing for 30 years and...
Well, and he's missing for most of this movie. It's really Ryan Gosling's story for the bulk of it. And I admire what they were able to do in following up this, you know, iconic Ridley Scott sci-fi film that has influenced so many other movies over the decades. I have to admit I was a little skeptical. One, it's really hard to sequelize a movie like that so long after the fact. But two, when so many other movies have picked the bones of that film clean, what is there really that you can do that feels new or fresh? And I have to say, they pulled this off to a large degree in a way that surprised me. Denis Villeneuve is the director of this. He also made Arrival, so he's definitely got a facility for these large-scale sci-fi films. But to be able to take the elements, the tone, and the feeling, the vibe of that original Ridley Scott film, and make something of it, to bring it in a direction that feels both of a piece with that film and also like you're watching something new and indelible is a real achievement.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the original, when you think of the original Blade Runner, it wasn't universally embraced at first, right? It was kind of tepidly received, and then it was recut, and that has generated a whole bunch of interesting debate over what exactly Ridley Scott intended or what the movie was about in general and whether or not Harrison Ford was a replicant or not. And that kind of interesting debate over whether machines are human, whether we're more machine and all that and what that means, is that in this movie, or is it kind of a futuristic space age cops and robbers movie?
It can be both. You know, I mean, I think what's interesting about the approach here and something that many people might find aggravating about it is that Villeneuve stretches, elongates every single moment, action, line of dialogue, or frame to the point where it really toes the line between ridiculous and sublime. But in so doing, makes it also feel so much more iconic, so much more titanic and in its grandeur. You know, he can take these lines that probably seem pretty rudimentary on the page, and in that way that he stretches them out, he imbues them with so much significance that you have to imagine another generation of fanboys is going to be parsing absolutely every nook and cranny of this film for, you know, all of its double, triple meanings.
Yeah. And then we had these iconic characters in the original, Rutger Hauer, of course, Daryl Hannah with her backflips, Sean Young. Do we have similar interesting actors in this one?
Well, there's Robin Wright as Ryan Gosling's boss, who wears an upturned collar, boots, and a sneer into that. There's actually a lot of great female characters in this, a lot of female replicants. I sort of took a shine to one who is the sort of henchwoman for Jared Leto's ultimate bad guy. She's this very composed henchwoman who can really hold her own in a fight, but then is also kind of motivated by spite and pettiness. At one point, she beats up Ryan Gosling, walks away, and she's like, I'm the best one. And I really do appreciate that. That's something that maybe the lead little girl in the Florida Project might have said. So to see this adult, sophisticated, impeccably made up replicant saying it in Blade Runner kind of brought a smile to my face.
So do you think we should go rewatch Blade Runner before we see this one?
You don't have to. I mean, if you're a Blade Runner obsessive, and there's obviously plenty of them, I'm sure you will not only rewatch Blade Runner now, but you'll watch it again after you've watched Blade Runner 2049. If you haven't seen it in a while, or even if you haven't seen it at all, you'll get by just fine. There's an introductory title card that tells you everything you need to know. There will be like a little, you know, some callbacks, some emotional visual hallmarks of the first movie that I think if you remember them, you'll feel them more deeply. But you'll get the gist.
Kyle Buchanan, senior editor, not a replicant, for New York Magazine.
That we know of.
That was, dot, dot, dot. You are the director's cut. Thank you, Kyle.
Thank you.
Coming up, I have a somewhat awkward conversation with a musician known as Saint Vincent next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 10 years ago, Annie Clark, better known as Saint Vincent, captivated the hearts of critics and indie music fans alike with her debut album, Marry Me. Her ethereal voice, her smart lyrics, her masterful guitar skills drew comparisons to Kate Bush and to David Bowie. But her sound has changed a lot in the last decade. My seduction. She's set to release her fifth solo album next week. It's called Mass Seduction. And on it, she takes her sound in a decidedly more 80s direction. Tomorrow, she kicks off her Fear the Future tour here in L.A. as part of the Red Bull Music Academy Festival running this month. And Annie Clark joins us now. Hi.
Hi.
All right. You said that this album is about sex and drugs and sadness, which is quite a trio. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. No, the record is kind of an homage to all things that can swallow you whole, like those powerful black holes, be them sex or drugs or sadness or you know, power.
And things you can swallow whole, that not only swallow you whole.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that was good. Oh, my God. I'm going to, I might work that into the press release.
Well, is this, you know, yeah, I know that a lot of musicians don't like to say this is something that is personal or about my life per se or autobiographical, but it's kind of hard to avoid it listening to
your
lyrics.
Why not? So why do they say that this isn't personal?
Well, I know.
It's music. That's so strange.
You know, and they say, well, these lyrics could be read many ways. It's not necessarily about my life, etc.
Whose life are they living that they can write about? No, I mean, it is. No, obviously, I think the thing you're speaking to is like there is obviously an element of narrative to it because it's art. It's not a blow by blow account, but it's certainly incredibly personal. But the idea is that it could be incredibly personal and then also totally universal in its first personness.
Mm-hmm. OK, well, let's talk about the personal part, if you don't mind. Do you mind?
Hit me, Oprah.
Let's talk about the drugs part. What drugs were you doing and how into them were
God. You? No, not really. I'm really not a druggy person. I was just dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression, so I was trying to more or less like find a way to walk through the world and deal partially pharmaceutically and then partially in other ways with like anxiety and depression and being on the road during that time. So that's where I'm coming from. I've never like put anything up my nose or anything. I'm from the suburbs of Dallas. I was just like trying to figure out how to deal with my life.
So anxiety and depression, was that something that is that something that you've dealt with your whole life, or is this something that's fairly new to you?
Oh, whole life.
So you have this song.
This is actually not the conversation that I was hoping to have.
Okay, what kind of conversation do you want to have?
No, I just mean like I'm the one who planted the sort of like unfortunate Easter egg of like sex and drugs and sadness, which I mean.
Well, you do have a song on the album called Pills.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Pills to wake, pills to sleep, pills, pills, pills every day of the week, pills to walk, pills to are talking about it publicly.
Oh.
And we as a culture are talking about it publicly. We're in the middle of a crisis of pharmaceutical drugs.
Oh, yeah, deeply so.
Okay. Let's move on to the sex part.
Oh, great. Heck, you're really, really, you're really going for it, Los Angeles.
Okay.
Ooh, drive time.
Well, why not? Let's get right to
it. Get you hot before work.
So the New York song, New York, on your album is a pretty sad song about breaking up. And is that a personal song about a personal breakup for you?
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's a composite for me, you know, it's about walking the streets of the East Village and thinking about the people who you've loved, who've walked those streets before you and gone on either to other cities or to other planes of existence, I guess.
New York is in New York without you, love. Too few of our old crew left on Astor. So if I trade out for some Hollywood.
So it's full of a word that we can't say on the radio or we'll lose our license.
Oh, is that the one?
That's the one. That's the one. Mother trucker. Uh-huh. So
sometimes I like to call my brothers-in-law that word, the MF word.
You do?
Yeah, because they're literally effers of mothers. And I just like them to sit with that and think about it.
Well, I guess all the dads in the world are. So.
Things are really not going well. This is not a good day for interviews. Let's just keep going.
Okay, all right. Let's move on. Ugh. I like this interview, actually. Okay, let's move on to Los Angeles. And you have a video out for that one. And it seems like you're really taking on the cliche of Los Angeles as being a... obsessed with cosmetic improvement.
In Los Angeles, the winter never comes. In Los Angeles, the mothers milk their young, but I can keep running. No, I can keep running.
You just moved here. Is that how you see LA?
Oh, yeah, that is a. They call that sandbagging.
Yes. Yes.
You're sandbagging me. This is like the hardest hitting journalism I have ever had. And we're just like trying to talk about a fun show. You're really going for it. You're really, you know.
How can anybody have you? How can anybody have you and lose you? How can anybody have you and lose you? Not lose their minds too.
Most flattering assessment of LA, but it's not my sole opinion of LA by any means. I really like being there. I find it to be a really wonderful place to work. But there is a certain amount of conspicuous consumption or you know, status. It's an industry town if you choose to operate in that world all the time, and that's it has a value system in large part that is different from my value system, or certainly something that I try to kind of like keep at bay. And again, I'm not talking about the whole of Los Angeles by any means. It's a megalopolis, you know.
Yeah. But it's hard in a showbiz world to keep that at bay because a lot of it is about image, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to be the person who got the plastic surgery memo, but like got it slightly wrong. Like I get a nose next to my other nose.
Kind of a Dada approach.
Yeah, like I think that like, well, butts are out, but calves are really in, you know. Anyway.
Okay, let's talk about the sound in this new album and how it differs from the previous ones. As I said in the intro, it has more of an 80s feel to it. Did you want it to harken back to the 80s in some way for a particular reason, or do you just like the sound of that?
I mean, I feel like the number of times I was like trying to reference like throbbing gristle drum sounds and mm-hmm. like Nine Inch Nails. Like I probably said Nine Inch Nails like 80 million times in the studio. Just, I don't know. So, I mean, there's certainly like a lot of talk of that kind of late 80s industrial music, which I'm a big fan of. And I worked with Jackie Antonoff. He co-produced the record. And
he's worked with Lorde and Taylor Swift and...
Yeah, so, and that's, the 80s are certainly, I guess, a soft spot for him as well, so.
Was that the music that was most influential to you as you were coming up?
No.
What was the most influential to you?
Oh, I think it's probably impossible to say what was the most influential. I mean, I don't know, it's sort of like relationships, too. You can have, like, one that lasts a day that, like, impacts you forever, and some that lasts for years that you're like, I went back to that, and like, that didn't really do it for me anymore.
What are you listening to now that you really like?
What am I listening to now?
Mm-hmm.
Terry Gross, Ira Glass, Invisibilia, Love and Radio.
That's called not sandbagging, but telling the interviewer what she wants to hear.
What? No, I'm saying that like I listened to so much NPR. That was that was like a high five.
Oh, okay.
Wait, did you think I was being a d-?
Well, a little bit. Yeah.
No, I wasn't sandbagging. I was saying I was just making a joke at how uncool I am. That's okay, that was the joke. Not, the joke was not on you.
But do you feel like sometimes you're misread? I've been reading some interviews where the interviewer feels like they don't really know if you're messing with them or not.
That I get misunderstood by mm-hmm. I mean, I did like construct a pink box in England and had like a girl in stripper shoes like direct them in, and there's this, I made a soundtrack for it that was like really disorienting. I mean, so yeah, like I don't know that I would say that I was misunderstood, because I'm not even sure what the point of making that was, except for to spice things up for me and make it a little bit like fun and, you know, make it an experience for people.
So you're going to be on stage here in LA tomorrow.
Yeah, what is... I am. I'm so excited about it. It's the it is the world premiere of the Fear of the Future tour.
This is part of the Red Bull Music Academy Festival.
Yes, it is.
What can we expect?
You can expect, first of all, a very unorthodox place to have a show. And then you can expect the staging of that show, even just like the walking around of that show, to be bizarre. And then you can expect a show that blooms like a flower. The hope is that it's beautiful and strange and something that people will walk away from going like, I'm really glad that I had that experience, as opposed to not having had that experience.
Well, Annie Clark, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It was nice to talk to you. I hope that you can air some of it.
Don't you worry about that. That's Annie Clark. She's better known as Saint Vincent, and she kicks off her Fear the Future tour tomorrow here in LA as part of the month-long Red Bull Music Academy Festival. Her new album is out next Friday, October 13th. It's called Mass Seduction. All right, Christian Bordahl. Hi.
That was some hard-hitting journalism there, Madeline Brand. You really went for it.
It's a little awkward. Okay. Well,
another victim of some hard-hitting journalism that we talked about earlier, Mr. Harvey Weinstein, mm-hmm. Hollywood power player, movie mogul, and apparently serial sexual harasser of women. Well, as you discussed earlier, a big surprise, not so much for people in the business. They kind of knew about this. Producer Felix K tweeted, "This isn't news. This is someone finally doing something about it." So I put up a little Twitter poll to get the wisdom of the crowd. I asked whether Harvey will be back or whether this will be the end of him and the Weinstein Co. And the final count is 27% say Harvey will indeed be back, bigger and better than ever. And 73% say, he's done. Listener Oscar Tarasena agrees. He tweeted, "Put a nail in his coffin. That's the end." Kind of interesting that Weinstein started his big apology by saying, "I came of age in the 60s and 70s when all the rules for bad behavior in workplaces were different. Uh-huh. That was the culture then." Sean Frisco says that's a canard. He says, "My heart goes out to that generation of women for the behavior they had to endure." So there you go. Okay. Harvey Weinstein.
All right. We will be talking about that for a while, I'm sure. Christian Bordahl, thank you very much. Have a
Absolutely.
Great weekend.
Yeah, you
it's
too.
It's been a crazy week. Thanks, you guys. You guys have a great weekend, too. I'll see you on Monday.